Texas Fish and Game Magazine, January-February 2025 issue, audio edition. In this issue, The Next Mega Bass, Three Lakes to Fish for Double-Digit Lunkers, feature article by Matt Williams. The Fish and Game Saltwater Playbook, Part 1, Mastering Topwater Lures for Speckled Trout, compiled by Chester Moore and TFG staff. Poaching in Texas, Teenage Poachers, A Hidden and Growing Crisis, feature article by Chester Moore. Floating Options, Exploring the Versatility of Kayaks, Paddleboards, and Inflatables, feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. Fish and Game Profiles, Doggett and Pike, Fish and Game Icons, Texas Outdoor Legends, feature article by Chester Moore. High-Tech Optics for Hogs, Using Technology to Combat the Feral Hog Invasion, feature story by Fish and Game staff. Plus, columns, Outdoor News in the Fish and Game Report, The Fish and Game Hunting Center, Coastal Focus Reports by Professional Saltwater Guides, and more. So listen, learn, and enjoy. Happy Fishing New Year. Inside Fish and Game by Roy and Ardia Neves. For those of us old enough to have looked forward to the year 2000 as the doorway to futuristic wonders, it's surreal to realize we're now standing at the quarter century mark of the 2000s. Yet here we are, happy 2025. After enduring the wild roller coaster that was 2024, hot on the heels of the House of Horrors that was 2020 to 2023, maybe, just maybe, we're in for a peaceful stroll through the next 12 months. Hopefully, we'll avoid any sharp turns, sudden drops, or unexpected loops. Of course, we have no crystal ball to predict what's coming economically, politically, or socially. All we can do is cross our fingers and have faith in the resilience of systems that usually manage to keep moving forward despite the shenanigans of mere mortals. What we can look forward to, however, with some degree of certainty, is a fantastic year for anglers. Our intrepid freshwater fishing editor, Matt Williams, kicks off this issue, see page 10, with a feature on three Texas lakes where serious bass anglers have their best shot at landing a double-digit lunker. Despite the long-term drought conditions gripping much of the state, two of these lakes continue to produce giant catches by the boatload. The broader theme of the piece is clear. Freshwater fishing in Texas is poised for a boom, thanks in no small part to the dedicated efforts of Texas Parks and Wildlife Fisheries biologists. Texas lakes have earned glowing recognition from BASS in recent years, with at least two Lone Star water bodies consistently cracking their top 10 U.S. lakes rankings. This reputation is well-deserved, and much of the credit belongs to the state's investment in freshwater fisheries research and hatchery production. Since its opening in 1996, the Freshwater Fisheries Center in Athens has been the backbone of the state's efforts to boost freshwater game fish populations. TPWD hatcheries annually produce more than 7.5 million bass, 1.2 million catfish, 5.8 million striped and hybrid striped bass, and a million other species, all destined to replenish reservoirs across Texas. One standout initiative is the TPWD Share Lunker program, which saw a banner year in 2024 and is poised to continue that momentum into 2025. Launched in 1986 with the record-breaking catch of Mark Stevenson's 17.67-pound largemouth, Ethel, who gained fame as a resident of the Bass Pro Shop's flagship store in Springfield, Missouri, the program has since become legendary. Initially, the Share Lunker program encouraged anglers to donate bass weighing 13-plus pounds and measuring over 24 inches for breeding purposes. Over the years, the program has expanded, allowing year-round entries in categories for 8-plus and 10-plus pound fish. Share Lunker bass are temporarily housed at TPWD hatcheries, where they contribute to the production of offspring designed to enhance the size and quality of the state's largemouth population. To date, the program has logged 3,854 entries, including 668 certified legacy fish, those 13-plus pounders caught during the January to March season. By the time this issue hits the streets, the 2025 season will be well underway, with new entries likely already in the books. Who knows? This could even be the year we see the Holy Grail, a new state record 20-pounder. Drought remains a concern for several major reservoirs across the midsection of Texas, where water levels are perilously low. Amistad, Falcon, and Choke Canyon are nearing single-digit capacity levels, while lakes in eastern and northern Texas remain near full pool. These low water levels haven't necessarily dampened, unintentional pun there, sorry, fishing prospects in the short term. They often concentrate fish in smaller areas, making them easier to find. However, the long-term impact, diminished habitat, and reduced forage could be damaging if drought relief doesn't arrive. Returning to the futuristic notion of our opening paragraph, 21st century technological advancements are transforming the sport of fishing for bass and many other highly targeted species. Forward-facing sonar, supercharged anchoring systems, and high-tech trolling motors have turned bass fishing into something that feels like a live-action video game. These tools have undoubtedly contributed to the surge in big bass catches and underscore how much the sport of fishing has evolved. Meanwhile, on the saltwater side of things, perspectives remain mixed. Conservation-minded anglers can appreciate the recent tightening of limits and the fall flounder closure as necessary steps to protect fish populations. On the other hand, those who see such measures as government overreach might be eyeing a for sale sign for their bay boat. Our take? Sure, getting out on the bay, wading a marsh or shell bed, or just hauling a bait bucket out onto a pier or jetty may be less rewarding in the amount of keepers for your freezer. But that experience is still a hell of a lot more enjoyable than sitting around and complaining about the good old days. So here's to 2025, another year of fishing, adapting, and making the most of the waters and opportunities we're fortunate to have. Email Ardia at aneves@fishgame.com. Email Roy at rneves@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Brave New World. Editor's Notes. By Chester Moore, Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. A Montana man has been charged and sentenced to 6 months in prison for trafficking and conspiracy under federal law for cloning a Marco Polo sheep, as well as breeding and selling its offspring and DNA across several states, including, you guessed it, Texas. In addition to his prison sentence, Arthur Schubarth, 81, of Vaughan, Montana, was ordered to pay $24,200 in fines and assessments, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. The Lacey Act prohibits interstate trade in wildlife that has been taken, possessed, transported, or sold in violation of federal or state law. The Lacey Act also prohibits the interstate sale of wildlife that has been falsely labeled. Marco Polo sheep are massive wild sheep that can grow to 400 plus pounds and sport horns measuring 65 inches. They inhabit Central Asia's Pamir Mountains in Mongolia, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, and can only be imported as trophies with strict permitting. That includes a Convention on the Trade of Endangered Species, CITES export permit from the country in which it was harvested, in addition to a permit from the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, USFWS, for import, possession, and other uses. Schubarth and five others labeled in court documents as persons A through E by federal officials were allegedly involved in various activities. Three persons are from Texas, one from Montana, and another from Minnesota. Court papers cite the following claims. On or about January 25, 2013, person A entered the United States with biological tissue from a Marco Polo Argali sheep that had been hunted in Kyrgyzstan. Person A did not declare the animal parts upon entry. On or about January 31, 2013, Schubarth entered into a cell storage agreement with a corporation for storage and preservation of the above-referenced tissue from a male Marco Polo sheep named Rocky. On or about October 6, 2015, Schubarth entered into an ovine cloning contract to clone an unspecified number of Marco Polo sheep from the tissue. He provided a deposit of $4,200 for the cloning. On or about November 22, 2016, Schubarth received 165 cloned Marco Polo embryos at the Schubarth Ranch. On or about May 15, 2017, a pure Marco Polo Argali sheep male was born from the cloned embryos, which Schubarth named Montana Mountain King. Starting in 2018 at the latest, Shubarth harvested semen from M1.1K in order to inseminate ewes via LAP AI to create Marco Polo Argali hybrid offspring. Other notes from the case involved sending semen straws from MMK to Texas, as well as transferring its offspring to Texas. Upon sending a list of questions about the case to the Department of Justice, one of their public affairs specialists replied, "Thank you for reaching out. Unfortunately, due to the ongoing nature of the case, we don't have any comment to pass along at this time." The cloning of the Marco Polo sheep from an as-yet undisclosed piece of tissue represents a significant advancement in cloning technology since the successful cloning of Dolly the sheep, the world's first cloned mammal, in 1996. This is the first significant case involving wildlife cloning, and it has potentially large implications across several areas of the wildlife industry beyond this issue with wild sheep. I'm not saying everything related to cloning and genetic tinkering is bad, but I believe it's my responsibility to address these issues and raise questions. The existence of a cloned Marco Polo sheep will not likely make any impact on native wildlife in this case. After all, the Texas Doll is a hybrid of a mouflon and domestic merino with some selective breeding thrown in, created by the Wyo Ranch in the 1970s. What concerns me is the cloning part. The fact that someone can clone wildlife and do it across international borders is something we need to at least examine. Perhaps an even bigger potential concern is gene editing. There are hogs that have had their genes edited to make them immune to the swine flu. They are being sold on the market as of 2024. And I interviewed someone very high up in the cloning business that described how gene editing could be used to deal with feral hogs. In theory, scientists could edit genes of a bunch of sows and cause them to only produce boars. Eventually, this would cause a population decrease, and on-island populations could potentially eliminate them in several generations. I can see animal rights groups salivating at the chance to use such tactics to lessen wildlife populations without killing them. Would whitetails in some areas be next? Like I said, I don't think all of this is bad. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has cloned a black-footed ferret from a cryogenically frozen specimen from the 1980s. It's living in Colorado today, and in fact, they have not only cloned ferrets, but the ferrets that were cloned have bred. We need to pay attention to what's going on in this arena. There can be good done, like bringing back endangered species, like the black-footed ferret, or even extinct animals like the thylacine, but there are things that raise huge questions about this technology. And Texas will be the epicenter of this, since non-indigenous wildlife is not regulated for the most part. We have entered a new age, and the technology is increasing so quickly it could get ahead of hunters, fishermen, and wildlife lovers before we know what's really going on. After all, it was only 7 years ago when I predicted these kinds of things would be an issue in 10 years. I was wrong. It's already happening in major ways. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Oopsie Daisy. Doggett at Large. By Joe Doggett, Texas Fish and Game Senior Contributing Editor. When I was a kid in Houston during the mid-50s, good old Santa delivered a classic lineup of young boy presents, a Lionel Electric train set, then a Schwinn bicycle, then a Zebco Model 33 spin cast reel, and a fiberglass Shakespeare Wonderrod. On my 11th Christmas, I hit the jackpot, a Daisy Model 25 BB gun. I was convinced the Model 25, with its long trombone pumping arm and spring-fed tubular 50-round magazine, was superior to the Red Ryder carbine with its lever-cocking design. The Model 25 shot straighter and hit harder. If you centered a Coke bottle just right, the BB would break the green glass. The Red Ryder looked more Western, but the projectile usually bounced off. I loved that air gun, and during the next several years ran umpty thousand BBs through it while plinking in nearby vacant lots and along the wild and uncut banks of Bray's Bayou. The Model 25 finally wore out, but not before teaching me a lot about the elements of proper rifle shooting: sight alignment, breath control, and trigger pressure. And the great majority of shots were taken while standing offhand, the most challenging position. The The lack of noise and recoil were huge allies in fledgling marksmanship. Frankly, I was a better offhand shooter back then than now. You can't press a trigger that many times and not become reasonably skilled. About 10 years later, at the Naval Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, we were required to shoot rifles from the easiest prone position at a 100-yard centerfire range. We used the old M1 Garand, chambered in 30-06 Springfield. We were stationed in a long firing line as the drill instructor paced back and forth. As I recall, each candidate shot 2 8-round M1 clips. We banged away with peep sights and the large rectangular paper targets were retrieved. The officer candidates were from all over the country, and shots were sprayed all over the targets. Some missed the entire paper. 4 or 5 of my shots were in the bullseye, and the remainder were punched in a fan several inches outside, nothing more than adequate with open sights, but all would have killed or seriously wounded a 100-yard combatant. The DI eyed the target. "Where are you from, officer candidate?" "Texas, sir." "Well, that explains it. Carry on." That was the first time I had fired a heavy centerfire rifle, and the mindset and muscle memory from the Model 25 laid the foundation. Early on, as kids will do, I made some foolish mistakes, but understood from the get-go the BB gun was not a toy. It was, in fact, a real gun. I took ownership seriously and tried not to carry it in an unsafe manner or aim it irresponsibly. Several neighborhood boys owned BB guns, and we often prowled the bayou banks. Parents did not object. We were outside in the open spaces and enjoying clean exercise, not plotting trouble with zip guns in some dark alley. Winter days especially were fun, more as we imagined real hunting. These were educational forays. For example, the quick splash of a BB near a distant floating object showed the significance of windage and elevation. Incidentally, at the sight of a group of armed youth strolling along South McGregor Way, no one called a SWAT team. For starters, no one knew what a SWAT team was. Times were different, a lot different, but many of the lessons on handling rifles remained the same. Most were positive, a few negative. One was bad, seriously bad. I was 13. My parents and I had returned from St. Paul's Methodist Church, and Mom was frying Sunday chicken. I was outside, pegging away at a brush pile near the driveway. I was not wearing protective shooting glasses. Mom called for lunch, and I decided to rapid-fire the remaining BBs into the mound of debris. I wailed away, blowing up dust and twigs, figuring 10 or 12 rounds remained in the tubular magazine. About midway through the John Dillinger Pump Fest, a bronze blur ricocheted back. I can still see it, incoming and curving slightly. The BB struck my left eye. The physical blow dropped me to my knees and made me sick to my stomach. Within seconds, the eye was hemorrhaging, and vision was lost behind a red film. So much for Sunday fried chicken. We rushed to nearby Texas Children's Hospital, and by great fortune, coincided with a convention of ophthalmologists at the Houston Medical Center. The BB struck the white cornea, not the blue iris, and failed to penetrate. Both eyes were taped shut to allow the trauma and swelling to relax. Apparently, blinking the good eye can put involuntary strain on the injured eye, and I had to remain in the hospital bed for several days, a terrible confinement of darkness and demons and doubts for a 13-year-old kid, or anybody. I learned that St. Paul's Church was not the only place for heartfelt prayers. When the doctor removed the gauze and patches, the left eye was watery and blurry. Mom and Dad standing bedside were vague silhouettes. But after several minutes of swabbing and blinking, the images in the room snapped into sharp focus. I was a young 2020 gunslinger again, and the wash of relief was overwhelming, one of the profound moments in my life. Several years ago, suffering from a maudlin case of nostalgia, I bought another Daisy Model 25. It cost about $40, a huge bargain for the memories it delivers. I plink on paper now and then in the walled courtyard of my Houston townhome, good refresher training with cheap ammunition and no noise and no neighbors calling 911. And you can take it to the nearest bank that I am wearing a pair of protective shooting glasses. Email Joe Doggett at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The Next Mega Largemouth Bass. Feature article by Matt Williams. Anglers looking to join the Mega Bass Club this year, recording official catches of 8, 10, and 13-plus pounders, can look to three Texas lakes as the most promising places to apply their efforts. O.H. Ivy and J.B. Thomas in West Texas, and the grandpappy of Sharelunker production, Lake Fork, in the east. Here is a profile of each. O.H. Ivy, Dalton Smith, likes to remember that eventful day back in December 2022, when he joined the budding list of anglers to discover Big Bass Nirvana on Lake O.H. Ivy. It was the third fishing day following a long journey he and Cole Logston had made to the famed West Texas fishery from their home state of Kentucky. Logston had boated an 11-pounder the day before, but Smith hadn't caught anything bigger than 5 pounds. Smith's luck changed in a really large way on December 30th. He landed a pair of OH Ivy Giants weighing 14.69 and 14.26 pounds, less than 3 hours apart, both on tiny swim baits rigged on spinning gear, matched with 15-pound braided line and a thin 8-pound leader. The fishing trip made a life-changing impression on the former Dale Hollow fishing guide and light tackle specialist. Less than a week later, Smith packed his bags and moved his guiding business to Ivy. He's been steering others to Texas-sized lunkers ever since. For those who may not know, Ivy has been the workhorse for Texas Parks and Wildlife's Toyota Sharelunker program in recent times, with 51 legacy class entries over 13 pounds over the last four spawning seasons, January 1st to March 31st. Among them are six top 50 fish, including two 17-pounders, three 16-pounders, and a 15.82, all caught making casts that likely never would have been made prior to the advent of forward-facing sonar technology. Bassmaster magazine ranked Ivy as the number two bass lake in America 2024, number one in 2023. If you're after a big girl, it's definitely a lake you don't want to overlook in 2025. Smith says there has been talk of the lake's trophy fishery showing signs of decline due to low water and increased competition for food, but he isn't buying it just yet. He predicts there will be another 10 to 14 legacy lunkers turned in this season. The lake is getting a lot more pressure than it used to, so it is naturally tougher for the average fisherman to catch them than it was a few years ago, Smith said. But there are still good numbers of 13 to 15-pound bass swimming around out here. I know those bigger fish are going to eventually die off, but the good thing is there are a bunch of 10 to 12-pounders coming up right behind them. The number of 6 to 7-pounders that are caught that you never hear about is astronomical. Perhaps no one is happier with Ivy's performance in recent times than Lynn Wright, the fisheries biologist who oversees the lake for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Wright agreed that Ivy is still holding good numbers of big fish. The bad news, he says, is the reservoir continues to shrink in size due to drought. The lake saw a welcomed rise of about 5.5 feet in September, but Wright said it wasn't enough to benefit much in the long term. The 19,000-acre lake was at 33% capacity, about 8,800 surface acres, in late October. Likewise, the competition for food is steadily increasing. Fishing is still good, and with the forward-facing sonar technology, anglers have four. They may continue to find the big ones at low water levels for a while, Wright said. But looking at my data, growth is slowing down, and the fish under 20 inches are getting skinny. The pipeline of bass coming up isn't flowing as fast as it was 5 years ago. As those teeners start to fade out due to old age, there are just not going to be as many backfilling as there were before. History shows us when the lake gets really low and competition for forage increases, fish growth rates are going to start tailing off. It's happened before. If the conditions don't change, I have to think it will do it again. Lake J.B. Thomas. Another West Texas lake big bass junkies won't want to overlook this year is J.B. Thomas. Located near Snyder, the remote fishery caught fire in 2023, and it's been smoking ever since. Through October, the 7,200-acre lake had produced 97 entries for the Toyota Sharelunker program in 2024 alone. Among them were two legacy-class fish, six legend-class, 13 pounds plus caught outside the January 1st, March 31st spawning window, 44 elite-class, 10 pounds plus, and 45 lunker-class, 8 pounds plus. Like O.H. Ivy, Thomas is starving for water. The lake level did jump about 13 feet in September, but was only about 36% of full capacity in late October, or 4,160 surface acres. Fishing guides Christian Gladfelter and Brandon Burks have enjoyed a wealth of success on Thomas. Check out their Facebook pages. It's gallery after gallery of Lunker largemouths. Both guides are experts with forward-facing sonar. Much of their success is owed to this real-time technology. Amazingly, Gladfelter steered Lawrence Lee of Tolar to 4 13-pounders in 2024, several of them coming at night during the heat of the summer. According to Gladfelter, Lee epitomizes what it takes to be consistently successful catching the big ones on the muddy water reservoir. Casts and retrieves have to be precision here, and Lawrence has it down perfect. The more conventional ways of bass fishing just don't work here. Most people don't have very good luck. Gladfelter pointed out that J.B. Thomas bass are different animals than those in most lakes. These fish aren't spot-oriented to structure, he said. They just show up in random areas. You might find an area with a bunch of big ones one day, and they'll be someplace else the next. Lake Fork. Lake Fork hasn't produced a legacy lunker since 2021, but the 45-year fishery near Quitman is a long way from being all washed up. Bassmaster magazine ranked it number 5 in the country last year. Through October, Fork anglers had reported more lunker-class fish for 2024 than any other Texas lake, 88, plus 20 elite-class fish over 10 pounds. Several of the entries were reported during the Bassmaster Elite Series event held there last spring. The event will forever be remembered as one of the greatest big bass slugfests of all time, as the entire top 10 earned century belt trophies for cracking the 100-pound mark over 4 days on 20 bass. The tournament champion, Trey McKinney, reeled in 130 pounds, 15 ounces, just shy of the BASS all-time 4-day weight record set by Paul Elias in 2008 at Falcon Lake. Though some were shocked by all the heavyweights reeled in by the Elite Series field, the big bass parade didn't come as a total surprise to Jake Norman. Norman is the fisheries biologist who oversees Fork and several other powerhouse lakes. The biologist said the Elite Series results confirm what he has been preaching for the past few years. The lake is bristling with bass in the 4 to 7 pound range, and they should continue stacking on weight. Those 4 to 7 pound fish have obviously kept growing, and I can comfortably say now that the lake is full of 5 to 9 pound fish, Norman said. I have always said Fork is still the best lake in the state, likely the country, to catch multiple fish over 8 pounds in one day. You have a better chance at a true giant other places, but I would still argue there isn't a water body that can give you multiple 8-pounders and a 35-pound-plus bag any day of the year. Thanks for listening. Saltwater basics. Mastering topwater fishing for speckled trout on the Texas coast. Feature article by Chester Moore. The Texas coast offers prime opportunities for topwater fishing for speckled trout, especially given the unique geography and diverse estuary systems found along its shores. From the deep marshes of Sabine Lake to the flats of the lower Laguna Madre, each region along the Texas coast presents distinct challenges and opportunities for targeting trout with topwater lures. Here are some Texas-specific insights to elevate your topwater fishing game. Timing: when to fish topwaters for speckled trout on the Texas coast. Early morning and late evening advantage. Morning and evening hours are particularly productive for trout along the Texas coast. The combination of warm Gulf waters and cooler land temperatures often results in a light onshore breeze at dawn and dusk, which helps keep surface waters cooler, ideal conditions for trout to feed aggressively on top. Spring through early fall. While speckled trout can be caught all year in Texas, the warmer months from late spring to early fall are peak seasons, as bait fish like mullet and shrimp are more abundant. The active spawning season from May through September also means more aggressive fish, making it a prime time for targeting trout on the surface. What about winter? As we said, trout can bite year-round on top waters, so don't give up during winter. Warm afternoons are best for winter trout fishing, especially on incoming tides when warmer Gulf waters enter bay systems. tides, and water movement. Texas coastal trout tend to favor locations with moderate tidal movements, especially in bays like Galveston and Matagorda. During these tidal shifts, look for areas where freshwater inflows meet saltwater, creating nutrient-rich zones that attract baitfish and, in turn, speckled trout. Techniques for fishing topwaters in Texas waters. Walk the dog in shallow flats. The Texas coast is home to vast grassy flats, particularly in regions like Rockport and Port Aransas. Walkers excel here, where the trout are often visible prowling the shallow water. Mimicking a wounded mullet or pinfish with a side-to-side walk usually triggers explosive strikes. Popping action for rougher conditions. Opt for a popper when fishing in choppier waters, such as around the jetties in Port O'Connor or the surf near Corpus Christi. The popping sound can attract trout even in low-visibility waters stirred up by coastal breezes or boat traffic, making it easier for trout to home in on the commotion. Adjust for Texas variability. Texas coastal waters can fluctuate in clarity and temperature, affecting trout behavior. Adjust retrieval speeds and pause lengths according to water clarity, slower retrieves for murkier water, and faster, more erratic movements for clearer conditions. Where to fish? Prime Texas locations for topwater fishing. Grassy flats in South Texas. The lower Laguna Madre, with its extensive seagrass beds and sandy potholes, is ideal for targeting trout in shallow water. Look for areas with a mix of grass and sand pockets where trout lie in ambush. Channels and drop-offs in East Texas. Areas around Sabine Lake and the Intracoastal Waterway are rich with channels and drop-offs that attract trout seeking baitfish. Fish these depth transitions during a moving tide for the best results. Marsh cuts and back lakes near the coastal bend. Texas's back lakes and marsh cuts, such as those found in the Aransas National Wildlife Refuge, provide protected zones teeming with baitfish. Target narrow passes and feeder creeks during tidal changes, as these areas act as natural funnels for trout to ambush prey. Walkers versus poppers on the Texas coast. Walkers. Best suited to calm days on Texas's expansive flats or shallow back bays. The sort of zigzag motion of walkers closely resembles Texas baitfish like mullet or pinfish, making it especially effective when trout are near the surface in calm water. Poppers. Poppers are ideal for working areas with surface commotion or rougher water. Use poppers around jetties, the beachfront, or during windy conditions when creating additional noise can be advantageous. Poppers are also highly effective near marshy areas with muddy bottoms, as the sound can lure trout in low visibility conditions. Topwater fishing for speckled trout along the Texas coast combines the thrill of the hunt with the reward of explosive strikes, making it one of the most exciting ways to enjoy Texas's opportunity-rich coastal waters. Sidebar: wakebaits for specks? Wakebaits, often used for bass fishing, can be surprisingly effective for targeting speckled trout in coastal waters. These lures are designed to create a steady wake just below or on the surface, imitating a slow-moving baitfish. The unique advantage of wakebaits lies in their ability to maintain a steady track, unlike walkers or poppers, which require specific rod movements. This steady motion makes them ideal for attracting wary or inactive trout, especially during warmer days or in calm, shallow waters along grass flats and marsh edges. The lure's subtle, continuous action can often draw strikes from trout that might ignore more aggressive topwater presentations. For best results, cast long grassy edges, sandbars, or channel drop-offs where trout often hunt. Wakebaits with a rattling component can be even more enticing, as the added sound helps alert trout to its presence, enhancing your chances of a strike in murky or low visibility conditions. Thanks for listening. Poaching in Texas, The Hidden Crisis. Feature article by Chester Moore. From Flipper, thrilling families on television in the 1960s, to modern-day dolphin encounters at aquariums and resorts, the love affair families have with dolphins is a strong one. So when game wardens in Orange County, Texas, found a dead dolphin impaled by a fishing arrow, it sent shockwaves across national media outlets. A couple of days after the incident, I spoke with the warden on the case. He revealed the type of fishing broadhead used in the incident was only sold at one location in the region, a popular archery shop. That has narrowed down our search. We'll find out who did this, he said. Officials did not expect that the perpetrators were two teenage brothers who, while bow fishing, came across a young dolphin that had wandered into freshwater. So instead of enjoying seeing the beautiful, protected marine mammal and reporting it was in an unusual area, they killed it. This happened a few miles from my home in 2015 and opened my eyes to a problem few in our industry have discussed other than Texas Fish and Game. We have covered this issue, but are taking it to a new level in this feature. In my opinion, Texas has a teen poaching issue, and we need to address it now. Killing cranes and eagles. Federal officials charged a teen from Jefferson County, just 30 miles away, for killing two whooping cranes less than a year after the dolphin incident. A judge ordered the 19-year-old to pay $26,000 in restitution, barred him from owning or possessing firearms or ammunition, and prohibited him from hunting or fishing in the U.S. He also got 200 hours of community service. Shortly after this made headlines, I asked a Galveston County game warden if she had noticed any trends in game and fish violations among teenagers. The answer blew me away. Yes, they need to stop killing our eagles. Take, for example, a 17-year-old Harris County, Texas boy who shot a bald eagle near White Oak Bayou. It was one of a pair that actively nested in the area for several years. What is going on? This is not an indictment of teens. It is not one of those rants we often hear in our culture like, the kids these days are rotten. I dedicate much of my life to working with teens. I believe in them and think there are things about the current crop of teens that shows incredible promise for our future. But this teen poaching thing must be addressed, and it must start with an admission. Most, if not all, of these teens came from hunting families. While we as hunters rightfully denote that poaching and hunting are radically different practices, these kids are familiar with game firearms and in several instances were engaged in legal hunting activities when an opportunity to poach came along. That means somewhere down the line, we must as a hunting community talk about this issue and find ways to engage it with them directly. But we need to ask some questions first. How much does parental influence play into this? There is no question some of these cases involve a long family line of game law violators. In a 2015 Leon County poaching spree, four adults and two juveniles were charged with over 175 state jail felony and Class A misdemeanor wildlife violations. Over a three-month period, they illegally killed at least 68 white-tailed deer and numerous other wildlife species across Leon County. The group used various firearms, including a rifle fitted with a silencer, to shoot animals from a motor vehicle on public roadways and private property without landowner consent, according to the Associated Press. In 2023, Texas Parks and Wildlife game wardens, along with Arkansas game and fish wardens, executed a search warrant in Texarkana connected to a poaching investigation. The case involved a small group of adults and juveniles suspected of wildlife violations in both states. The following are other factors that need to be examined. Social media notoriety. In our culture, some of the most famous people are now not those who have accomplished anything, but those who have broken laws or done other immoral things and published them on social media. Is there a link here between social media celebrity and teen poaching? Texas officials solved a 2020 Texas case because the teen that poached a deer that was well known in an off-limits-to-hunting community pasture bragged about it on Facebook. The power of suggestion. Unfortunately, social media and traditional outdoor media outlets have been a place for dark sentiment regarding wildlife. While we can agree that much of the green movement has little to do with protecting the environment, some of the rhetoric railing against it is quite dark and is hauntingly similar to things we see play out in some of these teen cases. A few years back, I encountered several people who used social media and at least one traditional outdoors media program to suggest shooting dolphins to cure ailing flounder populations. They are always out there in the passes, flipping those flounder out of the water and eating them. So we should start killing some of the dolphins. One of them told me in an email. This idea gained a large enough following to cause me to receive multiple messages advocating for it after I published an article on flounder conservation issues. Games. A few years ago, I received a hunting video game to review in the mail. I'm not a gamer, and since it was unsolicited, I did not review it but put it away in a box in our storage unit. When the dolphin shooting case occurred, I took it out for study. The game had multiple opportunities to kill non-game and even endangered animals like Bengal tigers. Some hunting games are ethical with bag limits, seasons, and other aspects of how true hunters conduct themselves. I would even say most hunting games I have looked at are now on the up and up and promote resource stewardship. But there's another side to gaming and wildlife. There are games based on survival and apocalyptic scenarios that have nothing to do with hunting. And killing animals is a key component. This includes many non-game, protected, and endangered species. This makes me come back to the quote from the warden in charge of a Pennsylvania teen poaching case. It was almost like a video game for them. They did it because they were bored, he said. Solutions? There is a gap somewhere in wildlife education and awareness of the penalties for these wildlife atrocities. Teens have had their lives uprooted by the consequences of these senseless actions. The great news is that there are far more teens engaged in conservation than poaching, and it's time we highlight them even more in our media outlets. The Houston Safari Club Foundation's educational work with Houston area school districts is a shining example. Teens get to see conservation-centric hunting information and are inspired to give back to our natural resources. And at the next stage, the scholarship program helps connect forward-thinking young people with careers in the world of wildlife management. Programs like Texas Brigades and others do a great job of instilling conservation awareness as well. As an industry, we must confront this for the sake of the future of wildlife and our youth. Thanks for listening. Last Chance, Texas Whitetails, by Larry Wysoon, Texas Fish and Game, Whitetail Hunting Editor. It happened last January, after I had spent several days at the 2024 DSC convention visiting with hunters who, like me, were headed to their deer camps as soon as the festivities completed to finish out their deer season on properties under Texas Managed Land Deer Permits. Lands under those approved wildlife management programs can hunt whitetails until the end of February. On our lease in Sterling County, out west of San Angelo, I still had buck and doe permits assigned to me that remained to be filled. I invited Luke Clayton, with whom I have been doing a weekly radio show since 2007, Catfish Radio with Luke Clayton and Friends, now also a weekly podcast like my DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, on www.outdooraction.com and many other places, and Jeff Rice. Jeff, Luke and I do a weekly television series on CarbonTV.com, A Sportsman's Life. I hope to take a couple of bucks and had asked Jeff and Luke to help me with my doe quota. We also hope to get footage to use in our show. Upon arrival, we headed to the range to make certain our rifles were properly sighted in. I was using two Rossi lever actions, 44 mag and 30-30 Win, and a new Mossberg Patriot in 7mm PRC topped with a Stealth Vision scope, stealthvision.com, shooting appropriate Hornady ammo. After dropping off Luke and Jeff, I headed to a blind on the backside of a long stretch of low country. I had scarcely sat down when I spotted three nice young bucks. Moments later, a short-tined ancient buck stepped out, one to remove. Not because of genetics, but because the forage he would consume if I passed him could be eaten by one of the younger bucks that had just walked by. I raised my rifle and shot him, then settled back to wait to see what else I might see, hoping for a doe or two. More bucks showed up at the feeder. Even though the rut was waning, bucks were still dominant. Does, having been bred, wanted nothing to do with pesky bucks. Way off in the distance, I saw more movement, which quickly turned into a huge herd of deer. In near awe, I watched 72 deer stream by. The closest was, unfortunately, over 500 yards away. The herd included bucks of all sizes, including six of the best bucks I had ever seen on the property, does and fawns. I watched as they ran to the head of the long draw I was on. I still have no idea what spooked the deer or how they had become such a large herd. I knew western Texas whitetails, typical of the plains, tended to be herd animal. But never outside of several years earlier, on the historic Rocker Bee Ranch in Irion County, had I seen such large number of whitetails together in one herd. I hope such a large herd might again form on our lease this January and February. I related what I saw to Luke and Jeff when I picked them up. Both had seen numerous deer, all bucks. The feeders where I had put them were apparently, too, dominated by bucks. Why so many bucks? Interestingly, for the prior 3 years, the property we lease had experienced a high fawn survival rate near 80%, as opposed to surrounding ranches where they had raised very few fawns, around a 10% fawn survival rate, those same past 3 years. What is interesting about the lease and a few other places I hunt and manage is I kept record of the sex of six-month-old fawns I observed while hunting. On the lease during the past few years, approaching 70% of the fawns I counted during the fall were bucks. This interestingly goes back to research done years ago on red deer in Europe. It was determined if a hind goes into the fall breeding season in less than good body condition, she tended to produce male offspring. Whereas, if she was in top body condition going into the fall, she tended to produce female offspring. In doing observations on numerous ranches I manage as wildlife biologist or where I hunted, this research seems to have validity in whitetails as well. We did finally shoot the number of does I needed to take. We put out Vineyard Max, wvineyardmax.com, at least 100 yards from where the corn feeders were. Initially, does could come there to feed, while bucks congregated and dominated the feeders. This worked for about 3 days before bucks took over the Vineyard Max feeding places as well. Thankfully, during the interim, we were able to harvest the remaining number of does on quota. By the time you read this, I'll be hunting my lease once again to see if the deer there during January and February are herding up. Surely, hope one of those biggest bucks I saw last January puts in an appearance. Email Larry Y. Soon at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Floating options. Exploring the versatility of kayaks, paddleboards, and inflatables. Texas Fish and Game staff report. Many entry-level anglers are hitting the fishing market not in a high-powered bass boat or big bay boat, but in kayaks, paddleboards, and other more easily portable and affordable vessels. And even anglers with the financial means for other boats are adding them to their arsenal due to portability and a stealth approach to fishing. In this issue, we thought we would look at a variety of innovations in this increasingly popular category. Next level kayak tech. The evolution of pedal-driven kayaks has redefined efficiency on the water. Early models introduced a simple way to free up hands for fishing or photography. Modern designs feature advanced systems that mimic natural leg movements, ensuring silent propulsion and reducing fatigue. These innovations allow paddlers to cover more water with less effort, particularly beneficial for fishing in expansive lakes or coastal areas. For urban dwellers or those with limited storage, modular and folding kayaks are game changers. Some brands are actually origami-like in nature, allowing for easy transportation in car trunks or even backpacks. Similarly, some allow anglers to assemble or disassemble their kayak, enabling adaptability between solo or tandem use. Kayak manufacturers are moving beyond traditional fiberglass and polyethylene. Advanced plastics and lightweight composites provide increased durability while reducing weight, which is a big deal for shallow water fishermen along the Texas coast and even bass anglers wanting to get in the skinny water and target spawning bass, for example. The integration of technology into kayaks has enhanced navigation, safety, and fishing. Smart kayaks, so to speak, feature mounting systems for GPS units, fish finders, and action cameras. Some models even incorporate solar-powered charging stations for devices. And of course, there are lightweight motors and shallow water anchoring systems for them as well. Fishing kayaks have undergone a bit of a renaissance, offering features such as customizable rod holders, built-in tackle storage, and live wells for keeping bait fresh. Stability is another focus, with wide, flat-bottom hulls ensuring anglers can stand and cast without tipping. Inflatable boats. Inflatable boats are an interesting part of this market. Gone are the days of flimsy, unstable inflatable boats. Modern innovations like high-pressure inflatable floors and drop-stitch technology provide rigidity comparable to hard-hulled boats. Companies have embraced these advancements, offering inflatable models that can handle rough waters while remaining surprisingly lightweight and portable. The use of advanced materials such as Hypalon and PVC-coated fabrics ensures durability against punctures and abrasions. Hypalon, in particular, stands out for its UV resistance and longevity, making it a preferred choice for high-performance inflatable boats used in harsh environments. Inflatable boats are no longer limited to oar power. Many models now feature transom mounts for outboard motors, transforming these vessels into versatile workhorses. Lightweight electric motors are also becoming popular. Manufacturers are introducing inflatable boats that cater to a variety of activities. Convertible models can shift between recreational paddling, fishing, and even diving platforms. Portability remains the hallmark of inflatable boats. Modern models pack down into compact bags, making them ideal for road trips, air travel, or remote adventures. Some brands like Zodiac offer quick inflation systems that minimize setup time, ensuring you spend more time on the water. Paddleboards. Paddleboards, traditionally associated with water sports, have become increasingly popular for fishing due to their versatility and eco-friendly nature. Their lightweight design and maneuverability allow anglers to explore shallow waters, narrow inlets, and areas inaccessible to larger boats, opening up new fishing opportunities. A paddleboard provides a stable platform for fishing, with many models specifically designed for the sport. These boards often feature wider decks, non-slip surfaces, and the ability to mount rod holders, tackle boxes, and coolers. Some even include anchor systems to stabilize the board in current or windy conditions, ensuring a hassle-free fishing experience. One of the key advantages of using a paddleboard is its stealth. Powered only by paddling, these boards glide silently through the water, minimizing disturbances and making it easier to approach fish without scaring them away. This stealth aspect is particularly useful for targeting species in clear or shallow waters, such as super spooky redfish. Paddleboards are also great for maneuvering into areas and then wade fishing. Actually, many anglers use kayaks for the same purposes. So if you're not so sure about actually fishing from these proven shallow water vessels, there are great options to get the boat to a safe destination and wade fish. The innovations shaping kayaks, paddleboards, and inflatable boats point to a future where these vessels become more accessible, efficient, and impactful for the angler. Whether you're navigating narrow river passages in a folding kayak or exploring coastal waters in a motorized inflatable, the possibilities are growing. We assume, since you're reading this in Texas Fish and Game, you are not only interested in seeing the beautiful sunrise over the bay or going out to birdwatch in a secluded location. You want to catch fish. And that's why we wanted to present you with some information on what's going on with these craft that can be a valuable part of an angler's arsenal. Thanks for listening. J.B. Thomas. It's Like the Wild West Out There. Texas Freshwater. By Matt Williams, Texas Fish and Game Freshwater Fishing Editor. The storybook fishing trips to shock the imagination continue to unfold at Lake J.B. Thomas near Snyder. To hear Christian Gladfelter and Brandon Burks tell it, it's been like the wild, wild west out there. Both fishing guides are pretty salty with forward-facing sonar. Their success is built 100% on their ability to read an electronic screen to locate suspended fish roaming around in open water, then tease them into biting with precision casts that 10 years ago would have never been made. Chris Chappellis of Alpine has witnessed the magic at the little West Texas lake multiple times over the past few months with the help of Gladfelter, owner of SlaunchGuideService.com. To wit, on the night of August 15, 2024, Chappellis experienced what may be the best after-hours fishing trip ever recorded on Texas waters. In 8 hours of fishing, Chappellis boated multiple bass over 8 pounds, including 3 over 10 pounds and 2 over 9. His heaviest 5 fish weighed nearly 55 pounds. One of the bass had a really serious weight problem. The fish weighed 14.9 pounds on a digital scale. That's slightly heavier than the 13.79-pound official lake record caught by Lawrence Lee of Tolar. The big bass was a real night owl. Chappellis caught the fish at about 2 a.m. All of the fish are documented in photographs on Gladfelter's Facebook page. "It was truly a wild night," says Gladfelter. "It was one of those fishing trips I'll never forget." Gladfelter has been using Garmin's LiveScope technology since it was introduced 2018. He relies on it exclusively to find and identify big fish. "I put the trolling motor down and don't cast until I find what looks to be a big fish, 8 pounds and up," he said. "Sometimes it might take 15 minutes, and sometimes it takes an hour or more." Gladfelter pointed out that J.B. Thomas bass are different animals than those in most lakes. "These fish aren't spot-oriented to structure," he said. "They just show up in random areas. You might find an area with a bunch of big ones one day, and they'll be someplace else the next." Gladfelter said all of Chopella's bass were caught within the same 50-yard stretch in 10 to 15 feet of water using one bait, a half-ounce jig he calls the Space Invader. Hot pink was the magic color that night. It's hard to imagine the fishing getting any better, but it did. During September 2024, Gladfelter says his boat has accounted for more than 250 bass over 8 pounds, including 20 double digits up to 13.36 pounds. Burke says he doesn't fool around much with trying to catch fish that look to be less than 10 pounds on his Lowrance active target screen. He claims his boat accounted for 17 bass over 10 pounds during September alone. Among them were 10 fish in the 10-pound class, 4 11-pounders, 2 12s, and a 13.22-pounder. Those are truly incredible numbers, unchallenged by any lake in Texas right now, perhaps the entire world. There is plenty of photographic proof on both of the guide's Facebook pages. It's gallery after gallery of plump bass with serious weight problems. "This lake has been fishing completely off the charts. It has been insane," he said. "There isn't another lake around fishing like this one." It hasn't always been that way. Built in 1952, the 7,200-acre reservoir has not been at full level since the early 1960s. In 2012-13, the reservoir was so starved for water it had dropped to 200 surface acres. Low oxygen levels spurred a significant fish kill that wiped out most piscatorial life. Things changed in September 2014 when remnants of a powerful Pacific hurricane dumped so much rain on the watershed that the lake went from under 200 acres to around 6,000 acres in size in a week's time. The rise flooded fields of terrestrial vegetation that sprouted during the extended drought, essentially creating a brand new lake. Texas Parks and Wildlife took advantage of the vibrant new lake effect by stocking nearly 79,000 Florida fingerlings in 2015, followed by additional stockings through 2024. It's logical to assume that the earliest stockings are largely responsible for the armies of big bass finning around out there today. It's worth noting that J.B. Thomas caught about 13 feet of water after heavy rains fell on the Colorado River watershed again in early September 2024. The welcomed rise spurred the lake from about 16.6% of full capacity to about 38% of full capacity. The reservoir currently spans about 4,200 surface acres. TPWD fisheries biologist Caleb Huber of Canyon said the most recent rise flooded an abundance of salt cedars and other terrestrial vegetation that sprouted at the lake's upper reaches over the last decade. The newly flooded cover will provide excellent spawning habitat for existing bass populations while serving as a nursery and playground for the Lone Star bass fingerlings the department plans to stock this spring. Email Matt Williams at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Doggett and Pike. Fish and Game Icons, Texas Outdoor Legends. Fish and Game Profiles by Chester Moore. This month, we begin a series honoring our columnists who provide us with such valuable content and inform us about their adventures in the great outdoors. We're going to start with two of the first people I met when I began my career, Joe Doggett and Doug Pike. Both were so kind and helpful to this young writer that their kindness left a powerful impression on me on how to treat others when I got in their position. Joe Doggett's career as an outdoor columnist spanned 35 years at the Houston Chronicle, where he began in 1972 and retired in 2007. Throughout his tenure, Doggett covered everything from fishing to hunting and even surfing, reflecting his deep passion for the outdoors. He was an early advocate for conservation efforts, particularly in promoting catch and release practices. Beyond his newspaper work, Doggett contributed to national publications such as Field and Stream, where he served as a contributing editor for nearly a decade. Even after retirement, Doggett writes for Texas Fish and Game. He occasionally does freelance pieces for various outdoor magazines, including Tailfly Fishing Magazine, where he shares his experiences and insights from his fishing, hunting, and surfing adventures. His firsthand experiences, such as wade fishing alongside legends like Rudy Gregar, provide a unique perspective on the evolution of Texas inshore saltwater fishing. He also does a lot of super cool fishing. Our last conversation was about him flying to the Bahamas to fish for bonefish. Doug Pike is a Houston native who has dedicated his career to sharing his passion for the outdoors and golf. He hosts The Doug Pike Show, which airs on Sports Talk 790. The show covers topics ranging from fishing and hunting to golf, appealing to both beginners and experts. It has been a staple for over 20 years. Before his broadcasting career, Pike spent 23 years as an outdoors columnist at the Houston Chronicle, where he developed a reputation for writing informative, passionate pieces on a wide variety of outdoors topics. Pike was involved in the epic waterfowl hunting on the Katy Prairie, which is, for the most part, a memory. His recollections of that area remind us of not only a bygone era, but also the need to conserve the habitat we have now and inspire a young generation to hit the field with us. Pike is bold in his writing for Texas Fish and Game, and sometimes challenges outdoors lovers on their perspective of conservation, as well as hunter and angler advocacy, and his work is always impeccable. Joe Doggett and Doug Pike have significantly contributed to outdoor journalism in Texas. Their writing and media presence has inspired countless individuals to engage with the great outdoors, and we are grateful to have them regularly contributing to Texas Fish and Game. Thanks for listening.
Two Toes Deep, Going Coastal, by Kelly Gross, Texas Fish and Game contributing editor. Winter on the Texas coast is a special time, especially for those in heavy pursuit of an elusive breeder speckled trout. Wading shorelines scattered with Spanish daggers and cactus, while keeping your eyes peeled for any kind of bait movement and casting into sandy potholes with a brisk chill in the air, is something that only us Third Coast anglers have the opportunity to experience. The Lower Laguna Madre is known for its world-class speckled trout fishery, and many travel from all over the globe for a chance at landing one of these mysterious predator fish. When targeting big speckled trout, one word comes to mind: persistence. Some days can be a grind looking for that one bite, but when it happens, it's pure magic. During the winter months, I like to wait until midday or the afternoon whenever the sun has risen overhead and warmed the waters a bit. These bigger trout like to feed on large mullet and other finfish that will be more active as the water temps increase a notch or two. Areas with plentiful grass and mud bottoms not only provide a safe haven for bait fish, but also keep big predator fish warm. Areas like this make for great speckled trout grounds, as well as ones with a slight drop-off to deeper, warm water. When it comes to gear to use when wading, I reach for the Shimano GLF B-Series 6'6 Medium Fast Rod. Shimano designed these all-new GLF B-Series rods with actions built specifically for anglers tossing artificial lures on the Gulf Coast. They have a shorter rod butt that is ideal for landing fish while wading. Spinning or bait casting, these rods have the right amount of action to work jig heads, topwaters, or swim baits, and have enough backbone to stick an overslot fish. Topwaters must be my all-time favorite artificial to use for speckled trout. The Hedden Super Spook and Rapala Skitterwalks are some of my go-tos. We experience a great deal of floating grass on the Lower Laguna Madre, and the treble hooks do snag a lot of it, resulting in the lure not walking properly. Switching out those trebles for single hooks makes all the difference and still catches fish. The aerodynamic DOA PT7 is a topwater made of soft plastic with a single 7-0 hook and a rattle inside. You can bomb this lure far and not worry about snagging grass. Historically, bone and pink-colored top pieces have been the most successful. Pictured with this article is Blaine Anderson of Shimano North American Fishing with his bucket list speckled trout he caught on a Terramar X700 rod and DOA PT7 right before sundown while wading a grassy flat with Captain Brian Barrera out of South Padre Island, Texas. We were slowly working the area and bombing our lures far away as possible. We had a few blow-ups and could feel there were giants amongst us. I was about 20 feet away from Blaine working my lure when I heard that unforgettable sound of trout slurping down a topwater. If I had a blindfold on, I would think that someone had thrown a large rock or brick into the water. That's the best way I can describe it. I heard the deep whoosh sound of the fish eating and tail smacking the water. I looked over and saw Blaine's ear-to-ear smile. He had traveled from South Carolina to experience our fishery, and he hooked up to quite the specimen. A 7-pound healthy speckled trout that had a very full stomach. I was happy to witness such an incredible moment for him. The combination of the historical freeze of 2021, the number of guide licenses annually distributed, fishing licenses sold to the public, and conservation efforts, new limits and regulations on trout came into effect in 2024. The limit is 3 15 to 20-inch speckled trout per person, and during a license year, one speckled trout over 28 inches may be retained when affixed with a properly completed spotted sea trout tag, and one speckled trout over 28 inches may be retained when affixed with a properly completed bonus spotted sea trout tag. It is your legal right to keep an oversized speckled trout with proper tagging, but the real reward and trophy is watching that fish swim away. A trout of that caliber can produce as many as 10 million eggs per season, allowing our incredible fishery to continue to flourish. And if a wall mount is what you are seeking, a nice photo, weight, and measurement is all you need to send to the taxidermist to have a replica made. One thing that is a fact about large trout is that they remain mysterious, hence the reward when landing one. It makes sense to fish deeper, warm water during a frigid day, but they may be on a shallow flat. If a big trout is what you are after, stick to your guns and go with your gut. With persistence and using your speckled trout senses, success is bound to reach the end of your line. Enjoy your winter pursuit of the almighty speckled trout. Email Kelly Gross at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening.
High-tech optics for hogs. Using technology to combat the feral hog invasion, Texas Fish and Game staff report. Thanks to breakthroughs in high-tech optics, hog hunting tools have come a long way. These innovations are giving hunters new advantages, making nighttime hog hunting more effective and helping keep feral hog populations in check. These modern optics are changing the game for hunters tackling these invasive exotics, which number more than 3 million in Texas alone. Thermal imaging scopes. Thermal imaging has become a go-to for hunters working after dark. Instead of relying on light like traditional night vision, thermal scopes focus on heat. This means warm-blooded animals like feral hogs stand out against cooler surroundings, making them easy to spot even in dense brush. High-definition thermal scopes go a step further, with color gradients that make distinguishing hogs from other objects easier. Many models even come with rangefinders, so hunters can calculate the exact distance to their target, boosting accuracy and helping ensure ethical shots. Old-school night vision. Traditional night vision uses an intensifier tube to amplify ambient light to allow a hunter to see in low-light conditions. The light enters the scope, is amplified within the tube, and produces a greenish image typical of analog night vision. This technology has been popular in military and hunting applications for decades due to its reliability. Digital night vision. While thermal imaging is powerful, digital night vision remains popular, especially as a budget-friendly alternative. Night vision scopes amplify available light, whether it's faint moonlight or starlight, to give hunters a clear image. This approach works well for close-range encounters and many night vision models have infrared IR illuminators that create an invisible light source only the scope can see. This lets hunters move in undetected, as hogs can't see IR light, making it easier to get closer without alerting them. Recording and sharing the hunt. Many high-tech optics now come with recording and live streaming features, allowing hunters to capture their hunts on video. Some hunters use these features to keep a digital record, track hog sightings, and create video logs for future reference, or simply post on YouTube. With the help of high-tech optics, hunters have a better chance at scoring on hogs and having an impact on controlling their populations. Large-scale hog population control has failed at every level, but on small properties, putting pressure on them will cause them to move eventually and at least give the property owners or leaseholders a reprieve from their destructive ways. Thanks for listening. The Fish and Game Report. News of the Outdoor Nation, reported by Texas Fish and Game staff. Game wardens honored for life-saving actions. In the early hours of March 17th, five Texas game wardens played a critical role in rescuing a man who had slipped while fishing off the Port Aransas jetties and had gone into the water. The day brought strong winds, and the jetties were wet and slippery due to recent rains, creating hazardous conditions. Nueces County game wardens John Falla, Kyle Hendley, Benjamin Jenkins, and Weldon Rapmund, and Harris County game warden Eric Taylor had been working a 14-hour enhanced patrol during the busy spring break season when they got the call. Even though their shift had ended hours earlier, the wardens continued working to assist local authorities. After the call came in, the wardens were among the first to arrive on the scene, quickly locating the man in the water. Despite the dangerous conditions, wardens navigated the slippery jetty to reach the unresponsive man. Upon reaching him, the wardens faced the challenging task of carefully transporting him up the jetties. As the man struggled to breathe, the wardens used a portable oxygen device until medical personnel arrived. With great care and teamwork, they carried him down the jetty to reach emergency medical personnel. The man was transported to a nearby hospital where he received further medical care and remained overnight. Thanks to the swift response, determination, and life-saving measures by the wardens, the man survived. On July 4th, Denton County Game Warden Kyle Allison and his partner responded to a medical call on Lake Louisville for a man who had suffered a boat propeller strike. After locating the boat, Allison boarded with his medical kit, assessed the situation, and applied two tourniquets to the victim's right thigh to control the bleeding. He kept the injured man calm, covered him to reduce shock, and coordinated the boat's transfer to shore, where EMS awaited. The Little Elm Fire Department Battalion Chief commended Allison's decisive actions, noting they were essential to the victim only losing his leg and not his life. Allison graduated from the Texas Game Warden Academy in 2012, serving Zapata County before transferring to Denton County in 2016. In October 2024, Allison was promoted to the rank of lieutenant and became one of the instructors at the Texas Game Warden Training Center in Hamilton. Director's Citation Award. On April 10th, the Texas Game Warden Aviation Unit deployed a helicopter crew to aid rescue operations during severe flooding in southeast Texas. The crew, consisting of Lieutenant Robert Mitchell, aircraft pilot, Sergeant Tyler Stoikes, tactical flight officer, and Michael Serbanek, McLennan County Game Warden and rescue swimmer, promptly responded to multiple emergency calls. Their first call involved rescuing a man stranded atop his semi-truck, encircled by rising floodwaters. The crew executed a swift hoist rescue, safely lifting the man from danger and transferring him to ground responders. Shortly after, the crew received a call regarding a woman who was pregnant and due for a C-section the following day. Her home was surrounded by floodwaters, and she was concerned about being unable to make it to her appointment and the possibility of labor difficulties. The crew was able to successfully evacuate her to a nearby fire station where she could receive further care. Later, while scanning the area with a thermal imager to locate additional flood victims, the crew detected the heat signature of another man stranded in the same area as the initial semi-truck incident. They were able to guide ground responders to his location, facilitating a safe rescue. This deployment highlighted the bravery, skill, and dedication of the flight crew, whose coordinated efforts saved lives amid dangerous conditions. Their ability to execute rescues under challenging circumstances underscores the impact of their rigorous training and teamwork. MAD Outstanding Service Award. The Southeast Texas chapter of MADI, in partnership with the Houston Law Enforcement Districts and the Harris County District Attorney's Office, honored the Harris County Game Wardens and their captain for their dedication to combating driving while intoxicated, DWI, and boating while intoxicated, BWI. Each year, MADI recognizes law enforcement officers who show exceptional commitment to safeguarding public roads and waterways from impaired drivers, acknowledging their vital role in preventing tragic accidents. MADI believes that every DWI and BWI intercepted is a potential life saved. The following wardens from Region 4, District 3 received an Outstanding Service Award for their recognition by MAD for their efforts in leadership, prevention, and enforcement, which have a measurable impact on reducing impaired driving and enhancing public safety. Texas Game Wardens Jordan Bagwell, Michael Blevins, Jamie Hill, Derek Lopez, Vinicius Mathias, Jeff Putnam, Tyler Zaruba, and Captain Randy Button. Texas Game Wardens serve with unwavering dedication and bravery, and I couldn't be prouder of these wardens for their exemplary service, said caller Ron A. Vanderroost, Director of Law Enforcement for TPWD. They have each demonstrated a level of commitment that goes above and beyond. Their actions not only saved lives and ensured public safety on our lands and waterways, but helped reinforce the trust and confidence our communities place in us every day. Thanks for listening. Layer Up. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Upper Coast Focus, Sabine Area. Reported by Captain Eddie Hernandez. Hello, winter. Welcome to Texas's northernmost stretch of coastline. Since there's not much I can do to prevent you from making your annual appearance, I will welcome you with open arms and accept what you have to offer. I realize that these next couple of months will not be the most comfortable when it comes to running the bay in pursuit of fish. I also realize, however, that for those of us who are willing to throw on some extra layers and get out there, the Sabine ecosystem can pay off in a big way. Years of logging, countless hours of wintertime fishing have taught us a thing or two. For starters, you have to be disciplined enough to grind it out in less than desirable conditions, hoping for a few big bites. Another thing is fishing the clearest water that you can find is a key ingredient for success. Don't waste your time fishing spots with murky water. Key on areas with good visibility and nice mud bottoms, preferably those where mullet are present. Clear water warms faster than murky water, mud warms quicker and retains heat better than sand, and bait is always our ally in chilly water. Although the difference in water temperature may seem very little to us, it can be huge to the fish. The slightest variance in water temperature can mean the difference between casting and catching. It may only be a couple of degrees or less, but that is very significant to the fish in cold water. Experience has also taught us that straight-tailed baits are more effective than those with a lot of movement. Wobbly baits like curl tails, which work great in warm water, don't really do much for these cold-blooded fish in cold water. A better scenario is to offer them a straight-tailed or fork-tailed soft plastic. Use the lightest jig head that the elements will allow and gently twitch it once it's on the bottom. As usual, the slower you work it back to the boat, the better when their metabolism is low. Some other good bait choices are slow-sinking mullet imitations such as Miralure Catch 2000 and Catch V, as well as Corky Original and Devils. These baits are designed to sink very slowly, so give them time to get down, then twitch and retrieve slowly. If you've got good sunlight penetrating the water, your best bet would be to use darker or natural-colored bait. Morning Glory, Red Shad, and Natural Mullet or Shad work well in bright sun conditions. Lighter colors like Chartreuse, Limetreuse, and White Ice are much more effective when the sky is overcast. The eastern bank of Sabine Lake has multiple bayous, cuts and drains that empty into the bay. Some of these open up into big shallow ponds that have their own drains and cuts. Because of the large amount of water that moves in and out with the tides, your chances of finding decent water to fish somewhere along the eastern shoreline are pretty good. If you're lucky enough to find clear water that's also holding bait, chances are you'll be happy you decided to layer up. Contact Captain Hernandez at ghgs.eddie@gmail.com or go online to goldenhookguide.com. Thanks for listening. Wild times ahead. Fish and game forecast, saltwater. Upper Coast Focus, Galveston Area. By Captain Derek York. Winter time on the Texas coast can be a wild one, with all of the cold fronts we get blowing through each month here on Galveston Bay, which can make for some sporty and sometimes dangerous conditions out on the water. But on the days when the weather calms down, you can definitely get on some fantastic catches. Redfish, spotted sea trout, and sheep's head are my go-to targets in the bay this time of year. The jetties can also be good for reds and black drum. Typically, on my charter trips while looking for trout, we throw popping corks with live shrimp or artificials drifting water anywhere from 3 to 7 feet deep. I am also always looking for birds working in the area. You will catch some redfish doing this as well. If you are looking for that trophy trout, we will be concentrating on mud bottoms as the water warms, throwing corkies and miralures. For sheep's head this time of year, I really enjoy working shoreline structure for them. I look for good bulkheads and transition areas where two different types of structure meet. For example, look for areas where there are metal bulkheads meeting a wooden bulkhead or even concrete walls. Many times, you will catch multiple fish off one spot, and don't be surprised to catch a personal best this time of year. We have put multiple double-digit sheep's heads in my boat in the winter. Clear Lake and all the bays along the Upper Houston Ship Channel provide plenty of habitat to target. I am always throwing live shrimp under a popping cork for these fish. Usually about an 18 to 24 inch fluorocarbon leader to a 1-0 circle hook or a number 6 treble with a split shot above the hook. One of the great things about wintertime fishing on the coast that often gets overlooked is fishing for red snapper in state waters. In recent years, there have been a lot of improvements in our area, just several miles from the Galveston jetties. Big Man Reef has been producing some quality snapper and provides a large area of artificial reef habitat that can easily be drifted or fished using a trolling motor with GPS holding capabilities. This area is located offshore of the west end of the island, about 8 miles out. Just remember to follow state regulations and don't travel out into federal waters with fish on board if the federal season is closed. State regulations set by TPWD allow for 4 fish per person with a 15-inch minimum year-round. With all the options this time of year, try to get out and get on some fish when the weather allows. Be sure to take some extra precautions with potential weather issues. I keep extra towels and a change of clothes on board, along with doing a float plan of some type to let people know where I will be and when I expect to be back home. Give me a call if you'd like to book a trip. Email Captain York at spotstalkerfishing@sbcglobal.com. Thanks for listening. Between the Fronts, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Upper Coast Focus, Matagorda Bay Complex. Reported by Captain Mark Talasek. Happy New Year to everyone. I hope all of you had a blessed holiday and were able to enjoy your family. As my time decreases on the water during the winter, I still enjoy fishing between the cold fronts. East Bay produces numerous trophy trout during the winter months. I'm going to talk about winter trophy trout tactics. Everyone wants the big one to put up on the wall. It's not an easy feat to accomplish. It takes hours on the water, studying patterns, along with some good old-fashioned luck. Most people in the fishing industry consider anything 25-inch plus a trophy. With current regulations, you can only snap a couple of photos of one that size. Hopefully, with numbers increasing, size limits will return to normal, giving people a chance to get that wall hanger. While most people want a skin mount, you can get a replica with a few measurements. This way, you can release the fish back into the water for another fight. To target one of these trophies, I like to use a corky or subsurface lure. Between cool fronts when the wind lays, I will usually fish midday. I will find a shoreline with some mud. The mud will warm up faster than the sand, which reflects the heat back. Tide movement and bait in the area is a plus. The bigger fish don't eat as often in cold weather. A bigger meal is what they search for, so a bigger bait will attract bigger fish. Patience is key. I have waited all day for only a couple bites, but the bite you receive is the one that you want. Warmer temperatures are a couple of months away for you fair weather fishermen. To book your next fishing or flounder trip to Matagorda, give me a call at 979-479-1397. Contact Captain Talasek at marktalasek@sbcglobal.com or go online to talasekguideservice.com. Thanks for listening.
New year, same fish habits. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Port O'Connor, reported by Captain Kim Golden. The Port O'Connor area offers a strong winter fishery for speckled trout, redfish, black drum, and flounder. The diverse structure and habitat of our protected backlakes and marshes can provide some hot action. With January comes consistently cooler air and water temperatures. Target species of speckled trout and redfish tend to be creatures of habit. Below are some tips that I hope will keep you consistently landing good fish this winter. 1. Water temperature. While we can't control water temperatures, we can be aware and use them to our advantage. In the Coastal Bend area, we are blessed with an extensive back lakes and marsh fishery. The bottom in these areas tends to be softer with a combination of soft sand and mud. These protected areas with softer terrain hold heat well from sunlight, whereas hard sand tends to allow the heat to escape at night. Baitfish will seek out this warmer, protected water, and gamefish will not be far behind. Areas with hard sand and scattered grass beds will warm up quickly once the sun is up. Keep those in mind on days we have a warming trend. Number 2, bait presence. Once our water temperatures sustain below 70 degrees, most of our summer bait fish and shrimp leave the shallow flats. Mullet becomes the major food source for our winter fishery. Because of this, I want to see some finger-sized mullet flipping before I commit to a wade. There needs to be something on the buffet for the game fish to hang around. Structure. With cooler water temperatures and mullet as the main bait source, focusing on the following areas should get you on your way to consistently landing fish. Soft bottom, protected water, leeward drop-offs, depth changes, windward coves, pinch points, guts in close proximity to marsh back lake areas. Winter fishing tip, present your lure through the entire water column, top to bottom. I hope you can find some time to fish the Port O'Connor area of the Texas Coastal Bend area this winter. Please be kind on the water, and I hope to see you out there. Contact Captain Golden at kimgoldenfishing@gmail.com or go online to portoconnorfishingtrip.com. Thanks for listening.
Bundle up for winter fun. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Upper Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Richard Thompson. We have finally arrived. Yes, at the best time of year. And no, I'm not talking about sipping pina coladas and chilling on the beach. I'm talking about bundling up in our Sims G4s, built for performance and wicking technology that keeps us out longer as we are extremely focused on chasing down that potential lifetime trophy speckled trout. Who is with us? We have put in the work and have spent many hours, weeks, and months leading to this epic time of year to learn these big girls' patterns. I want to share a couple known facts as to why our trout grow longer and heavier here in the Upper Laguna Madre and Baffin Bay systems than in other ecosystems. It is because of the rich nutrients and, according to biologists, the relatively consistent salinity level most significantly influences Baffin's production of big trout. Because of this condition, it limits the time our resident fish have to adjust their swim bladders in response to changing salinity levels, which impacts and correlates to their growth. The Upper Laguna, Baffin Bay, and Lower Laguna Madre all have one thing in common, not having large rivers feeding fresh water into the bays causing salinity levels to temporarily drop. These awesome facts make our coastal paradise one that is world-renowned for its trophy trout. From the Laguna Shores shoreline all the way down the King Ranch shoreline to Baffin Bay, we have protected flats and shorelines that hold bait with easy deeper water access, which creates the perfect environment for wade fishing these gator trout. One of our go-to methods that is proven and highly practiced by many professional guides, and especially my wife Crystal Thompson, is the use of her 1/8-inch Oz pink salty head lead head, and with the combo plum punch 6-inch and 8-inch dart bait from Coastal Brew Bait, are constantly producing hookups on these trout, as I am typically throwing a Corky and or XL soft dines 9 times out of 10, still producing, but not at the rate she is. More times than not, I see her out producing me with large trout, making me doubt my lure of choice and eventually switching over. However, I prefer to use the Nuke Juice and the new White Flash 6-inch dart baits, also made by Coastal Brew Baits. We are now moving further south and sometimes through the land cut and all the way down to Port Mansfield to hunt down the 30-inch beast. But it's not always necessary because we are able to catch these big gals right around the corner from the boat ramp here in Corpus Christi. So in short, these fish are here in the Upper Laguna Madre too. To close, we want to applaud TPWD on the fact that the new size and bag limit placed on trout is paying off in dividends, and we have personally witnessed the growth in bigger trout. Keep up the good work and continue to be a responsible advocate for conservation so we can continue restoring our historically rich trout population to what it once was. Contact Captain Thompson at rnkcoastaloutfitters@gmail.com or go online to rnkcoastaloutfitters.com. Thanks for listening. New year, new tactics. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Rockport. Reported by Captain Jared McCulloch. What an odd start to the fall and following into winter. Tides staying high into the start of duck season. I can only guess that the birds were staring at their maps, questioning why the back lakes looked so different. But late high water hanging out is only a benefit to fishermen. If you had been pulling hooks from a bunch of mouths in early November, most redfish caught had pretty sharp teeth. Signs of being fresh to the flats and back lakes, meaning we are headed into a plentiful winter as they stacked up from the deep water. But now it's January, the heart of winter. Low water, sparse grass, guts and ledges hold good fish. A simple cut mullet can quickly become your best friend if you're staying in your boat. The water is cold enough that the majority of perch have retreated to deeper water, so your live shrimp stand a chance of finding the mouth of a tasty fish. Dirty water and shrimp go hand in hand, especially around reefs. Everything from trout to reds, drum, even your smiling sheep's head are hanging out midday around a big reef. Play the tide charts to your benefit. Big drops force as many fish off the flats into guts and ledges. For the wade fishermen, a lot can be the same. Working guts or deeper outflows from the back lakes with smaller, slow-sinking lures can be the cat's meow. A simple day with low walking and excellent turnout. My favorite winter lure is a 3-inch DOA CAL in stark naked. Pair it with a short hook 1/8 ounce or 16th ounce for thicker grass. Slow retrieves. Watch for the take on the fall instead of the twitch. Remember, the water is cold and the fish won't be as hyper, but they still want to eat. Don't discount simple colored spec rigs. I have a group of guys that like to come down on short notice right after a hard front every year, and all they throw are spec rigs from my boat, and boy can they clean up. Just because it's an outdated lure doesn't mean it's worthless. They figured out a good little combo of watching the weather this time of year and lures they really like to maximize their shot at phenomenal days of fishing. Finding a couple of scenarios you can repeat over and over can really maximize your fishing and cut down on the searching this time of year. Contact Captain McCulloch at firstlighttexas@gmail.com or call 210-478-6519. Thanks for listening. Tips for the novice or the pro. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Lower Coast Focus, Baffin Bay, reported by Captain Jared Merritt. We at Paradise Guide Services hope every one of our readers had a very Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and an amazing Thanksgiving. We always appreciate everyone's interest in the information we try and share about Baffin Bay and surrounding areas. With that said, let us talk about fishing in January and February. This time of year is great for the angler looking for the one, but it can also be great for the novice crew. Either way, start with attempting to pick the right weather patterns and days. For a novice group or a family trying to get the kids in on the action, I typically try to fish 2 days or more after a northern front blows in. The wind may still be from the north, but has settled down by this point and is not going to blow us off the water. The pressure is usually starting to change and become better for a fish bite to take place. This benefits us as we are trying to get novice fishermen hooked and wanting to come back for another enjoyable experience. Our unique rock structures, along with fish that often warm up in the shallows early in the morning, create a great fishing experience for anglers of all skill levels. With family groups or new anglers just wanting to see if they will enjoy the water, we typically recommend live shrimp under a popping cork. Similar approaches can also be applied for the fishermen that are looking for the one. This group tends to be a little more hardcore, and we typically suggest wade fishing with lures or live shrimp under a popping cork. When it comes to lures, we recommend bringing an assortment of what you enjoy throwing. A lot of the success is due to the confidence in a lure and adjusting if needed when the neighboring angler is having success with a different color or lure. As much as we are working and doing different things this time of year, we always encourage anglers to bring an assortment of plastics. Rest assured, however, we will always have a few different options on hand to help. We base lure selection on water temperature, water clarity, and what the sky is doing, but also advise you to throw what you are comfortable with. Later in the day, the shallows might warm up more than what the bait fish are comfortable with. Due to this, we typically start by fishing shallow water early and deeper water once the sun gets up. We look for grass lines early and structure later in the day, depending on water color and visibility. We can tailor any trip, so do not think you have to be a professional to enjoy the beautiful waters and fishery that Baffin Bay and the Land Cut offer. Contact Captain Merritt at jaredmerritt@gmail.com or visit his website, paradiseguideservices.com. Thanks for listening. Fish and Game Hunting Center. Introducing Youth to Big Game Hunting, story by Shane Smith. There is no better feeling than watching a younger hunter bag their first big game animal. Whether it is a deer, hog, or bear, watching them take the shot and seeing the sheer excitement on their faces when they put their hands on the animal is truly something special. But there are many moving parts to get you from point A to point B. If you don't have a plan in place, you very well may not get the smile of a satisfied hunter, but you can rather turn a youth completely against it. There are several moving parts that are different for a big game hunt over other youth hunts, such as squirrel or rabbit. So let's go over a few tips to make sure they have a great day in the woods and make memories that will cement them in the outdoors for years to come. Set them up for success. Have a blind or stand that provides you with plenty of game that is under the 100-yard mark. This usually means corn or some type of feeder to attract the big game and keep them occupied. If possible, show them pictures from game cameras at the hunting location to get them excited about the hunt and the area. Range time. Set aside some time to let the youth shoot the weapon to become somewhat familiar with the gun. Don't wait until the animal is in range to try and show them where the safety is and how to properly squeeze the trigger. It goes without saying to always stress safety and to treat every gun as though it is loaded and to keep pointed in a safe direction. Don't go small on caliber. This is by far the biggest mistake I see people make in taking youth hunting bigger game like deer and hogs. They will reach for their trusty AR-15 chambered in 5.56 or a single shot 223. Yes, all of these weapon systems can dispatch big game with one shot. But shot placement is paramount here. This is where I err on the side of a larger caliber rifle. My twin boys are 8 and have killed dozens of hogs with my AR-10 chambered in 6.5 Creedmoor. The felt recoil is very minimal, and they are shooting a 129-grain bullet instead of a 44-grain. There are several other options out there that fall into this category. 6.5 Grendel, 6mm ARC, 243, 6.8 SPC, and the 7.62 39mm. These calibers all give the youth a bit more leeway as far as shot placement and still won't have the sinful recoil of typical big-game rifles. Use a suppressor if possible. A suppressor will provide the youth shooter a bit more of recoil relief in addition to not hurting their ears. I also love the fact that you get the instant report of hearing the bullet impact the animal. I know a suppressor can be expensive, but much like any quality optic, you buy once and cry once. Bring a tripod or have a steady shooting platform. If you hunt in a blind or tree stand, make sure you have something in place to rest the gun on. Setting the gun up and having it somewhat where it needs to be will eliminate unnecessary movements that could spook the game. This also gives the youth the best chance for a clean one shot, one kill. Keep them comfortable. I bring extra seat cushions to make sure my boys are comfortable and not squirming the whole time due to seats that don't really fit them. Also, grab a few snacks that are quiet to open. Bring a thermocell if you have mosquitoes in your woods. Where we live, the bugs can make or break your hunt if you don't have some type of repellent. Taking youth out hunting big game is very rewarding and very challenging. Set your youth up for success this fall and get them in the woods to enjoy the outdoors every chance you get, and I promise you that you won't regret it. Thanks for listening. Flaws in the logic of banning hunting. Aptitude Outdoors by Texas Fish and Game contributing editor Paul Fusinski. The idea of banning hunting, as advocated by some animal rights activists, is based on the belief that protecting individual animals will result in a flourishing wildlife population. And I'm happy to report this animal rights-driven ideology was pushed back in Colorado, where Proposition 127, which would have banned all mountain lion and bobcat harvest, was defeated. The anti-hunting perspective, while well-intentioned, overlooks critical ecological, economic, and management realities that have long-term consequences for wildlife. The flaw in this logic stems from a basic misunderstanding of how wildlife populations are maintained and the important role hunting plays in conservation efforts. First, animal rights activists often assume that by banning hunting, wildlife will thrive. They overlook the complex ecological balance that hunting maintains in a world where human populations are continually growing and competing for resources. In regulated hunting systems, wildlife populations are managed through scientific data to prevent overpopulation, ensure genetic diversity, and maintain ecosystem health. Without human intervention, many species would experience unchecked population growth, leading to habitat degradation and widespread starvation or disease outbreaks. Hunting acts as a tool to help balance these populations. Second, the argument for banning hunting does not address the economic vacuum that would be created if hunting-related revenue ceased. As outlined by the North American model of wildlife conservation, a large portion of funding for habitat restoration, wildlife research, and law enforcement comes from the mandated sale of hunting licenses, permits, and excise taxes on hunting equipment. Without these critical sources of revenue, there would be little to no financial support for conservation programs. Animal rights activists often suggest non-consumptive activities like ecotourism or wildlife observation as alternatives. These industries cannot generate the same level of consistent funding. If you don't agree, look at Africa, where according to Sue Tidwell in her book Cries of the Savannah, one hunter can generate the same revenue as 29 photo tourists. With studies showing that hunters spend up to 30 times more than ecotourists, and their contributions are more widely distributed, benefiting local communities far beyond the concentrated areas that ecotourism supports. Furthermore, replacing this lost income through public taxes or grants would be challenging and unpopular, and there is no guarantee these funds would be allocated effectively or even ever generated. Lastly, a ban on hunting would likely lead to unintended consequences for wildlife and ecosystems. For example, species like deer or elk that thrive in environments altered by human activity could quickly reach unsustainable population levels in the absence of controlled hunting. These overpopulated species would not only suffer from lack of food and shelter, but would also cause severe damage to forests, grasslands, and other habitats. This would, in turn, have ripple effects on other species, potentially leading to further declines in biodiversity. Paradoxically, the very wildlife that activists seek to protect would end up suffering more under a hunting ban. In sum, the push to ban hunting disregards the practical realities of wildlife management and conservation in the current state that this planet is in. It underestimates the ecological role that hunting plays in population control and overestimates the ability of alternative funding mechanisms to replace the substantial economic contributions of hunters. The flawed logic in the argument to ban hunting risks doing more harm than good to the wildlife populations it seeks to protect. This is not a utopia where wildlife and human beings all get along and everything is fun and fancy-free. This is the real world where wildlife needs to be carefully monitored and conserved, or they will disappear, putting us right back in the early 1900s. The short-sightedness of activists in calling for a ban on hunting is not only impractical, but dangerous for wildlife conservation. Their failure to present a viable alternative to the North American model reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of how conservation works and the critical role hunting plays in funding and managing wildlife populations. This lack of a practical solution threatens to undo a century of progress, leading to further habitat destruction, overpopulation, and severe ecological imbalances. By pushing for policies that ignore the realities of conservation funding, they risk causing the very extinction events they claim to oppose. Without hunting and the substantial revenue it generates, wildlife populations would spiral out of control, suffering from starvation, disease, and habitat loss. In their idealistic vision, animal rights activists overlook the harsh truths of nature and the need for human intervention. Their deeply flawed utopian logic endangers the future of wildlife far more than the regulated hunting they seek to eliminate. Without a workable solution, their calls for action will lead to a collapse in conservation efforts, leaving wildlife populations to suffer and decline in ways far more brutal than a hunter's bullet. Email Paul Fusinski at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. This concludes this audio edition of Texas Fish and Game Magazine, January-February 2025. We hope you have enjoyed this issue. Print and digital versions of this publication are available on our website, fishgame.com. This has been a production of Texas Fish and Game Publishing Company, LLC. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved.